This is a recorded section 10 of A Philosophy of Freedom, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path by Rudolf Steiner. Chapter 14, Individuality and Genus. The view that human beings are capable of self-enclosed, free individuality seems to be contradicted by the fact that as human beings we both appear as parts within a natural whole, race, tribe, people, family, male or female gender, and act within that whole, state, church, and so forth. We bear the general characteristics of the community to which we belong, and we give to our actions a content that is determined by the place that we occupy within a larger group. Given all this, is individuality possible at all? If human beings grow out of one totality and integrate themselves within another, can we consider separate human beings as wholes unto themselves? The qualities and the functions of a part are determined by the whole. An ethnic group is a whole, and all who belong to it bear the characteristics determined by the nature of the group. How the individual is constituted and how the individual behaves are determined by the character of the group. Thus the physiognomy and the activity of the individual have a generic quality. If we ask why this or that about a person is this or that way, we must refer back from the individual to the genus. This explains to us why something about the individual appears in the form we observe. But human beings free themselves from what is generic. If we experience it properly, what is humanly generic does not limit our freedom, nor should it be made to do so artificially. As human beings, we develop qualities and functions of our own, whose source can only be sought within ourselves. What is generic about us serves only as a medium through which we can express our own distinct being. We use the characteristics nature gives us as a basis, and we give these the form that corresponds to our own being. We look in vain to the laws of the genus for an explanation of that being's actions. We are dealing with an individual, and individuals can be explained only individually. If a human being has achieved such emancipation from the generic, and we still want to explain everything about that person in generic terms, then we have no sense for what is individual. It is impossible to understand a human being fully if one bases one's judgment on a generic concept. We are most obstinate in judging according to type when it is a question of a person's sex. Man almost always sees in woman, and woman in man, too much of the general character of the other sex, and too little of what is individual. In practical life, this does less harm to men than it does to women. The social position of women is unworthy, for the most part, because it is at many points determined not as it should be by the individual characteristics of an individual woman, but by the general mental picture that others form of the natural duties and needs of the female. The activity of a man in life is determined by his individual capacities and inclinations. That of a woman is supposed to be determined exclusively by the fact that she is, precisely, a woman. Woman is supposed to be a slave of the generic, of what is universally womanish. As long as men debate whether women are suited to this or that profession, quote, according to their natural disposition, unquote, the so-called woman question cannot evolve beyond its most elementary stage. What women are capable of according to their nature should be left to women to decide. If it is true that women are suited only to the profession that is currently allotted to them, then they will hardly be able to attain any other on their own. But they must be allowed to decide for themselves what is appropriate to their nature. Anyone who fears a cataclysm in our social conditions if women are accepted not as generic entities, but as individuals, should be told that social conditions in which one half of humanity leads an existence unworthy of human beings are conditions that stand in great need of improvement. Footnote: as soon as this book appeared, 1894, the objection was raised against these comments, that within what is appropriate to their sex, women can already live as individually as they like and much more freely than men, who become de-individualized through school, war, and profession. I know that this objection will be raised today, 1918, perhaps even more strongly than ever, Still, I must let these sentences stand and hope that there are readers who understand how completely such an objection runs counter to the concept of freedom developed in this book, and who judge the above sentences of mine by standards other than the de-individualization of men through school and profession. End of footnote, author's note. Those who judge human beings according to generic characteristics stop before the boundary beyond which people begin to be beings whose activity is based on free self-determination. What lies short of that boundary can, of course, be an object of scientific investigation. Racial, tribal, national, and sexual characteristics form the content of specific sciences. Only persons who want to live merely as examples of a genus can fit themselves into a generic picture derived from such scientific investigation. But all these sciences together cannot penetrate to the specific content of single individuals. Where the region of freedom, in thinking and action, begins, determination of individuals by the laws of the genus comes to an end. The conceptual content that, in order to have full reality, human beings must connect with a percept through thinking cannot be fixed once and for all and bequeathed in finished form to humanity. Individuals must gain their concepts through their own individual intuitions. How an individual should think cannot be derived from some generic concept. Each individual must set the standard all alone. Nor is it possible to tell from general human traits which concrete goals an individual chooses to seek. Anyone who wishes to understand a particular individual must penetrate to that individual's particular being, not remain at the level of typical characteristics. In this sense, every single human being is a separate problem. All science concerned with abstract thoughts and generic concepts is only a preparation for the kind of cognition imparted to us when a human individuality communicates to us in its way of viewing the world. And all such science is only preparatory for the kind of cognition we attain from the content of a human individuality's willing. When we have the sense that we are dealing with the aspect of a person that is free from typical styles of thought and generic desires, then we must make use of no concept from our own mind if we want to understand that person's essence. Cognition consists in linking a concept with a percept through thinking. For all other objects, the observer must penetrate to the concept by means of his or her own intuition. Understanding a free individuality is exclusively a question of bringing over into our own spirit in a pure form, unmixed with our own conceptual content, those concepts by which the individuality determines itself. People who immediately mix their own concepts into any judgment of others can never attain understanding of an individuality. Just as a free individuality frees itself from the characteristics of the genus, cognition must free itself from the approach appropriate to understanding what is generic. People can be considered free spirits within the human community only to the degree that they free themselves from the generic in this way. No human is all genus, none is all individuality. But all human beings gradually free a greater or lesser sphere of their being, both from what is generic to animal life and from the controlling decrees of human authorities. Our remaining part, where we have yet to win such freedom, still constitutes an element within the total organism of nature and mind. In this regard we live as we see others live, or as they command. Only the part of our action that springs from our intuitions has moral value in the true sense. And what we have in the way of moral instincts, through inheritance of social instincts, becomes something ethical through our taking it up into our intuitions. All the moral activity of humanity arises from individual ethical intuitions and their acceptance in human communities. We could also say that the ethical life of humanity is the sum total of what free human individuals have produced through their moral imagination. This is the conclusion reached by monism. Final questions. The consequences of monism. The unitary explanation of the world, the monism portrayed here, takes the principles needed to explain the world from human experience. It also looks for the sources of action in the observable world, that is, in the human nature, accessible to our self-cognition, particularly in moral imagination. Monism refuses to seek the ultimate causes of the world that appear to our perceiving and thinking by making abstract inferences about something outside that world. For monism, the unity brought to the manifold multiplicity of percepts through the experience of thinking, observation, is both what our human urge for cognition demands and the means by which this urge for cognition seeks entry into the physical and spiritual regions of the universe. Those who seek another unity behind the one sought in this way merely prove that they do not recognize the correspondence between what is discovered through thinking and what is demanded by our drive for knowledge. The single human individual is not, in fact, cut off from the world. The individual is a part of the world and has a real connection with the whole cosmos, which is broken only for our perception. At first, because we do not see the ropes and pulleys by which the fundamental powers of the cosmos turn the wheel of our own lives, we see our individual part as an entity existing by itself. Whoever remains at this standpoint sees a part of the whole as an actually independent entity, as a monad that somehow receives information about the rest of the world from outside. The monism advocated here shows how such independence will be believed in only as long as thinking does not weave what has been perceived into the network of the conceptual world. Once this happens, the existence of separate parts is unmasked as a mere illusion of perceiving. Only through the experience of intuitive thinking can we find our total self-contained existence within the universe. Thinking destroys the illusion of perceiving and integrates our individual existence into the life of the cosmos. The unity of the conceptual world, which contains objective percepts, also includes the content of our subjective personality. Thinking gives us the true form of reality as a unity enclosed within itself, while the multiplicity of percepts is only an illusion conditioned by our organization. In every age, cognition of the real, as opposed to the illusion of perceiving, has constituted the goal of human thinking. Science has striven to recognize percepts as reality by discovering the lawful connections among them. But wherever it has been believed that the connections transmitted by human thinking have merely subjective significance, the actual ground of unity has been sought in an object set beyond our world of experience, parenthesis, an inferred God, will, absolute spirit, etc., parenthesis. And, based on this opinion, attempts were then made to achieve, in addition to knowledge of connections recognizable through experience, a second kind of knowledge, based not on experience, but on metaphysical inference. This kind of knowledge went beyond experience and revealed a connection between experience and entities that are no longer directly available to us. On this basis, then, it was believed that we can understand the coherence of the world through orderly thinking because a primal being built the world according to logical laws. The reason for our actions was also seen in the will of this being. Yet it was not recognized that thinking simultaneously encompasses the subjective and the objective, and that full reality is conveyed in the union of percept with concept. Only as long as we regard the laws that permeate and determine percepts in the form of abstract concepts are we dealing with something purely subjective. The content of a concept joined to a percept by thinking is not subjective, for the content of this concept is taken not from the subject, but from reality. It is the part of reality that perceiving cannot reach. It is experience, but not experience transmitted by perceiving. Those who cannot imagine that a concept is something real are thinking only of the abstract form in which they hold concepts in their mind. But concepts, like percepts, are present only in this separated form because of our organization. The tree that we see has likewise no separate existence by itself. The tree is only a part in the great system of nature, and is only possible in real connection with nature. An abstract concept by itself has just as little reality as a percept by itself. Percepts are a part of reality that is given objectively. Concepts are the part that is given subjectively, parenthesis, through intuition, see page 88, 89, and forward, parenthesis. Our mental organization tears reality into these two factors. One factor is apparent to perceiving, the other to intuition. Only the union of the two, the percept integrating itself lawfully into the universe, is full reality. If we consider mere perception alone, we do not have reality, only disconnected chaos. If, on the other hand, we consider only the lawfulness of percepts, we are dealing merely with abstract concepts. Abstract concepts contain no reality. Reality lies in thinking observation that does not one-sidedly examine either concepts or percepts by themselves, but rather considers the union of both. Not even the most orthodox, objective idealist denies that we live in reality and are rooted in it by our real existence. Such idealists only deny that our cognition, our ideas, can reach that real life. Monism, in contrast, shows that thinking is neither subjective nor objective, but a principle that spans both sides of reality. When we observe with thinking, we execute a process that itself belongs to the order of real events. Through thinking, we overcome inexperience itself, the one-sidedness of mere perceiving. We cannot piece together the essence of reality with abstract conceptual hypotheses, parenthesis, purely conceptual reflections, parenthesis. We live in reality by finding ideas to match our percepts. Monism does not seek to add anything to experience that is not experienceable or transcendental, but it sees the real in concepts and percepts. Monism spins no metaphysics for merely abstract concepts, for in the concepts by themselves it recognizes only one side of reality, which remains hidden to perceiving and makes sense only in connection with the percept. Monism evokes the conviction in us that we live in the world of reality, and that we need not seek outside our world for a higher reality that we cannot experience. Because it recognizes the content of experience itself as reality, it seeks absolute reality nowhere but in experience. It is satisfied by that reality because it knows that thinking has the power to guarantee it. What the dualist looks for only behind the observable world, a monist finds within this world itself. Monism shows that in cognizing, we grasp reality in its true form, not in a subjective picture that interposes itself between ourselves and reality. For monism, the conceptual content of the world is the same for all human individuals. According to monistic principles, one human individual considers another human individual to be of the same kind, because the same world content expresses itself in both. Let me read that again. According to monistic principles, one human individual considers another human individual to be of the same kind, because the same world content expresses itself in both. In the unitary world of concepts, there are not, for example, as many concepts of the lion as there are individuals who think about a lion. There is only one concept. The concept that A adds to the percept of the lion is the same as that of B, only it is grasped by means of a different perceptual subject. Thinking leads all perceptual subjects to the common conceptual unity within all multiplicity. The unitary world of ideas expresses itself in them as in a multiplicity of individuals. As long as we understand ourselves merely through self-perception, we see ourselves as the separate human beings that we are. As soon as we notice the world of ideas that lights up in us, embracing everything separate, we see what is absolutely real light up livingly within us. Dualism fixes on the divine primordial being as that which permeates all humans and lives within them all. Monism finds this universal divine life in reality itself. The conceptual content of another human being is also my own conceptual content, and I see the other as other only as long as I am perceiving, and not once I am thinking. Each person's thinking embraces only a part of the total world of ideas, and to that extent individuals also differ through the actual content of their thinking. But the contents exist within a self-enclosed whole that contains the thought contents of all human beings. The universal primordial being permeating all humanity thus takes hold of us through our thinking. Life within reality, filled with thought content, is at the same time life in God. The merely inferred, not to be experienced, transcendent realm is based on a misunderstanding by those who believe that what is manifest does not bear within itself the reason for its existence. They do not realize that through thinking they can find the explanation for perception that they seek. This is why no speculation has ever brought to light a content that was not borrowed from the reality given to us. The God derived through abstract inference is only the human being displaced to the beyond. Schopenhauer's will is human willpower made absolute. Von Hartmann's unconscious primordial being, composed of idea and will, is a combination of two abstractions of our experience. Exactly the same can be said of all transcendent principles based on thinking that has not been experienced. Let me read that sentence again. Exactly the same can be said of all transcendent principles based on thinking that has not been experienced. In truth, the human spirit never moves beyond the reality in which we live, nor does it need to. For everything needed to explain the world lies within it. If philosophers declare themselves content in the end with the derivation of the world from principles borrowed from experience and displaced into a hypothetical beyond, then such satisfaction should also be possible if the same content is left here, where it must be for the kind of thinking that we can experience. Every transcendence beyond this world is only apparent, and the principles transposed outside the world explain the world no better than those lying within it, nor does thinking that understands itself demand any such transcendence, since it is only within the world, not outside it, that a thought content must seek a perceptual content together with which it can form something real. The objects of imagination, too, are merely contents. They find their justification only in becoming mental pictures that point to a perceptual content. Through that perceptual content, the objects of imagination integrate themselves into reality. A concept supposedly filled with a content and lying outside the world given to us is an abstraction and corresponds to no reality. We can think only the concepts of reality. To find reality itself, we also need to perceive. For thinking that understands itself, a primordial essence of the world whose content is invented, is an impossible assumption. Monism does not deny the conceptual. On the contrary, it even regards a perceptual content lacking its conceptual counterpart as falling short of the complete reality. Yet it finds nothing in the whole realm of thinking that could require us to step outside of the realm of its experience by denying the objective spiritual reality of thinking. According to monism, a science that limits itself to describing percepts without penetrating to their conceptual complements is only half complete. But it also sees as incomplete all abstract concepts that find no complement in percepts and that cannot fit into the conceptual network that spans the observable world. Therefore, it recognizes no ideas that refer to something lying objectively beyond our experience and that are supposed to form the content of a merely hypothetical metaphysics. For monism, all such humanly created ideas are abstractions borrowed from experience, an act of borrowing that is simply overlooked by the borrowers. Just as little, according to monist principles, can the goals of our actions be taken from an extra-human beyond. To the extent they are in our thought, they must stem from human intuition. Human beings do not make the purposes of an objective, transcendent, primordial being their own individual purposes, but follow the purposes given to them by their moral imaginations. A person detaches the idea that realizes itself in an action from the single world of ideas and sets it at the base of his or her will. Thus, our actions express not commands from the beyond injected into our world, but human intuitions that belong to this world. Monism recognizes no world dictator who would assign aim and direction to our acts from outside ourselves. Human beings find no such primal source of existence whose advice could be sought to learn the goals that we must give our actions. We are returned to ourselves. We ourselves must give our actions their content. We seek in vain if we seek directives for our will outside the world in which we live. If we go beyond the satisfaction of natural drives for which Mother Nature has provided, we must seek such directives in our own moral imaginations, unless we find it easier to let ourselves be directed by the moral imagination of others. That is, we must either forego all action or act according to reasons that either we give ourselves from the world of our ideas or others give us from the same source. If we move beyond our sense-bound life of instinct and execution of the commands of other human beings, then we are determined by nothing other than ourselves. We must act out of an impulse that we set ourselves, and that is determined by nothing else. To be sure, this impulse is conceptually determined in the one world of ideas. But in fact, it can be drawn down from this world and translated into reality only through a human being. It is only within human beings themselves that monism can find a basis for the human translation of ideas into reality. Before an idea can become an action, a human being must first want it. Therefore, such wanting has its source in human beings themselves. Human beings are thus the ultimate determinants of their actions. They are free. This is the end of the last chapter, and I'm reading the addenda to the new edition, 1918. 1. The second part of this book has sought to establish that freedom is to be found in the reality of human action. For this it was necessary to separate out from the whole realm of human actions those aspects about which, from unprejudiced self-observation, one can speak of freedom. These are actions that realize conceptual intuitions. Other actions, when viewed without prejudice, cannot be called free. Yet precisely through unprejudiced self-observation we should consider ourselves well equipped to progress along the path toward ethical intuitions and their realization. But this unprejudiced observation of human ethical nature cannot by itself offer a final decision about freedom. For if intuitive thinking itself sprang from some other entity, if its own essence were not self-sustaining, then the consciousness of freedom flowing from morality would prove to be an illusion. The second part of this book, however, finds natural support in the first. The first presents intuitive thinking as an inner spiritual activity of the human being that is actually experienced. But to understand this essence of thinking experientially is equivalent to knowing the freedom of intuitive thinking. If one knows that this thinking is free, then one also sees the region of the will to which freedom is attributable. We will consider human acts to be free if on the basis of direct inner encounter we can ascribe a self-sustaining being to the experience of intuitive thinking. Those who cannot do so will also be unable to find an incontestable path to the acceptance of freedom. The experience emphasized here finds in consciousness the intuitive thinking that also has reality beyond consciousness. With this, it discovers freedom to be characteristic of actions flowing from the intuitions of consciousness. The content of this book is built on intuitive thinking that can be experienced purely spiritually, and through which every percept is placed within reality during the act of cognition. No more was to be presented than can be surveyed from an experience of intuitive thinking. But we must also emphasize what kind of thought formation the experience of thinking demands. It demands that intuitive thinking not be denied as a self-sustaining experience within the process of cognition. It also demands that we acknowledge its capacity, in conjunction with percepts, to experience reality, instead of seeking reality only in an inferred world outside experience, in the face of which the human activity of thinking would be merely subjective. Here, then, thinking is characterized as the element through which we, as human beings, enter spiritually into reality, and no one should confuse this worldview based on the experience of thinking with a mere rationalism. But on the other hand, it follows from the whole spirit of this portrayal that the element of perception can be considered as real for human cognition only if it is grasped in thinking. The characterization of something as reality cannot occur outside thinking. Therefore, we should not assume that sense perception is the only guarantee of reality. We can only wait for the percepts that emerge in the course of our lives. The only question is whether we can, from the viewpoint of intuitively experienced thinking alone, await perception not only of what is sensory, but also of what is spiritual. We can indeed wait for this, for even if, on one hand, intuitively experienced thinking is an active process performed within the human spirit, on the other hand, it is also a spiritual percept grasped with no sensory organ. It is a percept in which the perceiver himself or herself is active. And it is an activity of one's self that is simultaneously perceived. In intuitive thinking, human beings are also transferred into a spiritual world as perceivers. What approaches us in that world as a percept, in the same way as the spiritual world of our own thinking, we recognize as the world of spiritual perception. This perceptual world would have the same relation to thinking as does the sensory perceptual world on the side of our senses. As soon as we experience it, the spiritual perceptual world cannot be anything strange to us as human beings, because we already have in intuitive thinking an experience of a purely spiritual character. A number of my later writings discuss such a world of spiritual perception. This book, Intuitive Thinking is a Spiritual Path, The Philosophy of Freedom, is their philosophical foundation. In this book, an attempt is made to show that the experience of thinking, properly understood, is already an experience of spirit. Therefore, it seems to me that whoever can adopt the point of view of this book in earnest will not stop short of entering the world of spiritual perception. To be sure, what is portrayed in my later books cannot be logically derived, inferred, from the contents of this book. But a living grasp of what is meant in this book by intuitive thinking will naturally lead onward to a living entry into the world of spiritual perception. That is the end of the book, and I'm also going to add on here the appendices from 1918. Appendices 1918, number 1. Philosophical objections, raised immediately after the publication of this book, call for the addition of the following brief discussion to this new edition. I can imagine that there are readers who take an interest in the other contents of this book, but who will regard what follows as a superfluous, remote, and abstract web of concepts. They may leave this brief discussion unread. But problems crop up in a philosophical contemplation of the world that have their origin more in certain thinkers' prejudices than in the natural course of human thinking itself. Other issues treated in this book seem to me to present a task that concerns every human being who strives for clarity in regard to the essential nature of human beings and their relationship to the world. What follows, however, rather involves a problem, some treatment of which is called for by certain philosophers in any discussion of the things portrayed in this book. This is because those philosophers have created for themselves certain difficulties that do not otherwise exist. If we bypass such problems completely, some people will be quick to make accusations of dilettantism and the like, and the opinion would gain ground that I have not sufficiently come to terms with viewpoints I have not discussed in the book itself. The problem to which I refer is this. There are thinkers who believe that a special difficulty arises when one seeks to understand how the soul life of another human being can affect one's own, that of the observer. They say, quote, "My conscious world is sealed off within me, My conscious world is sealed off within me, just as any another conscious world is sealed off within itself. I cannot see into another person's world of consciousness. How then can I come to know that we both inhabit the same world?" Unquote. Those who hold the world view that it is possible to infer from the conscious world the existence of an unconscious world that can never become conscious try to solve this difficulty by saying, quote, "The world that I have in my consciousness is the representation in me of a real world that I cannot consciously reach. In this real world, unknown to me, lie the causes of my conscious world. My own real being, of which I have likewise only a representation in my consciousness, also lies there. But this real world also contains the essential being of my fellow human beings. Now, what another person experiences in consciousness corresponds to a reality in that person's essential being, which is independent of this consciousness. The person's being is active in a realm that cannot become conscious, the realm of my own necessarily unconscious being. It is through that realm that a representation is created in my consciousness of what is present in a consciousness altogether independent of my conscious experience." Unquote. We can see that a hypothetical world inaccessible to conscious experience is here added to the world accessible to my consciousness. Otherwise, these philosophers believe we would be forced to assert that all the external reality I seem to have before me is only the world of my consciousness, and this would lead to the solipsistic absurdity that other people also exist only within my consciousness. This question, which has been created by some recent epistemological trends, can be clarified if we attempt to survey the matter from the viewpoint of the spiritually oriented observation described in this book. What then do I have before me when I face another person? I look at what is immediately apparent. It is the sensory bodily appearance of the other person, given to me as a percept, and perhaps also the auditory percept of what the person is saying, and so forth. I do not really stare at all of this. Rather, it sets my thinking activity in motion. By my standing before the other person and thinking, the percept proves to be, to some extent, transparent to the soul. When I grasp the percept through thinking, I am bound to say to myself that it is not at all what it appears to be to the external senses. By what it is directly, the sensory phenomenon reveals something else that it is indirectly. Its presentation before me is at the same time its extinguishing as a mere sense phenomenon. But what it manifests during that extinguishing compels me as a thinking being to extinguish my own thinking for the period of its activity and to replace it with its thinking. I grasp this other thinking and my own thinking as an experience, as I do with my own. I have really perceived the thinking of the other person. The immediate percept, extinguishing itself as a sensory appearance, is grasped by my thinking. And this is a process lying completely within my consciousness, which consists in my thinking being replaced by the other thinking. Through the self-extinguishing of the sensory appearance, the separation between the two spheres of consciousness is actually suspended. This is represented in my consciousness in that, in experiencing the content of the other person's consciousness, I experience my own consciousness just as little as I experience it in dreamless sleep. Just as my daytime consciousness is shut out in dreamless sleep, so is the content of my own consciousness when I perceive another person's. The illusion that this is not so persists because, first, when perceiving another person, what replaces my own content of consciousness is not unconsciousness, as in sleep, but rather the content of the other person's consciousness. And second, the oscillations between the extinction and re-illumination of my consciousness of myself follow one another too rapidly to be normally noticed. The whole problem cannot be solved by artificial conceptual constructs that infer from what is conscious other things that can never be conscious. It must be solved through true experience of what results from a union of thinking and percepts. This applies to many questions that appear in the philosophical literature. Thinkers ought to seek the path to unprejudiced, spiritually oriented observation, but instead they slide an artificial conceptual construction in front of reality. In a treatise by Edward von Hartmann, quote, Ultimate Questions in Epistemology and Metaphysics, unquote, my book is classed with philosophical works based on, quote, epistemological monism, unquote. Von Hartmann dismisses this standpoint as impossible for the following reason. According to the way of thinking he develops in his treatise, there are only three possible epistemological positions. We can remain at the naive position that takes perceived phenomena as real things outside human consciousness. In that case, we lack critical awareness. We would be unaware that the content of consciousness is, after all, only in our own consciousness. We would not see that we are dealing not with a table in itself, but only with the object of our own consciousness. Whoever remains at this standpoint, or after reflection returns to it, is a naive realist. But this point of view is untenable, precisely because it fails to see that consciousness has no access to objects outside consciousness. Alternatively, we can survey the situation and fully acknowledge it, and in this case we become transcendental idealists. As such, we have to deny that anything of the thing in itself can ever enter human consciousness. But in this way, if we are sufficiently consistent, we would be unable to escape absolute illusionism. The world confronting us would transform itself into a mere sum of objects of consciousness, indeed the objects of our own consciousness, and we would be compelled absurdly to think of other human beings as also existing only in the content of our own consciousness. Only the third position of von Hartmann's is supposed to be tenable, transcendental realism. This view assumes that there are things in themselves, but that they cannot become immediate experiences of consciousness. Things in themselves cause the objects of consciousness to appear from beyond human consciousness, but in a way that does not enter consciousness. We can arrive at things in themselves only by inference from the content of our consciousness, which, though only mental pictures, is our only kind of experience. Von Hartmann claims that an epistemological monism, which is how he describes my position, would really have to embrace one of his own three positions. He claims that such a monism fails to do so only because it does not draw the proper conclusions from its premises. He goes on to say, long quote now, if one wants to find out to which epistemological position a supposed epistemological monist belongs, one need only present him with certain questions and compel him to answer them. For on his own he will not be inclined to express himself on these points, and he will also try in every way to evade answering direct questions, because every answer nullifies epistemological monism's claim to be a standpoint distinct from the three others. These questions are as follows. 1. Are things continuous or intermittent in their existence? If the answer is continuous, then we are dealing with some form of naive realism. If the answer is intermittent, then it is transcendental idealism. But if the answer is that they are continuous on the one hand, parenthesis as contents of absolute consciousness, or as unconscious mental pictures, or as possibilities of perception, parenthesis, and intermittent, on the other hand, parenthesis, as contents of limited consciousness, parenthesis, then transcendental realism is established. 2. If three persons are sitting at a table, how many instances of the table are present? Whoever answers one is a naive realist. Whoever answers three is a transcendental idealist. But whoever answers four is a transcendental realist. Of course, this last example presupposes that we may combine under the common heading instances of the table such disparate things as the one table as thing in itself and the three tables as perceptual objects in the three consciousnesses. If this seems to be too great a freedom, he or she will give the answer one and three instead of four. 3. If two persons are alone in a room together, how many instances of those persons are present? Whoever answers two is a naive realist. Whoever answers four, namely an I and an other in each of the two consciousnesses, is a transcendental idealist. But whoever answers six, parenthesis, namely two persons as things in themselves and four persons as objects of mental picturing in the two consciousnesses, is a transcendental realist. Whoever wanted to prove that epistemological monism is a standpoint different from these three would have to give a different answer to each of these three questions, but I do not know what this could be. End of quote. The answers of intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, the philosophy of freedom, would have to be as follows. 1. Those who grasp only the perceptual contents of things and take it for reality are naive realists. They do not realize that those perceptual contents can be considered as persisting only as long as they are observed, and therefore that what is before us must be thought of as intermittent. But as soon as we are aware that reality is present only in thought-permeated percepts, we arrive at the insight that the perceptual content that appears as intermittent, if it is permeated by what is worked through in thinking, reveals itself to be continuous. What we must therefore consider to be continuous is the perceptual content grasped in directly experienced thinking, of which what is only perceived would have to be regarded as intermittent, if, as is not the case, it were real. 2. When three people sit at a table, how many instances of the table are present? There is only one table present. But as long as the three people want to stay with their perceptual images, they have to acknowledge that these perceptual images are in no way a reality. As soon as we switch over to the table as grasped in their thinking, the one reality of the table reveals itself to them. They are united in that reality with their three contents of consciousness. 3. If two people are alone in a room together, how many instances of them are present? There are most certainly not six, not even in the sense of transcendental realists, but only two. Yet initially both have only the unreal, perceptual image of themselves, as well as the other person. There are four of these images, and through their presence in the two people's thinking, reality is grasped. In this thinking activity, each person reaches beyond his or her own sphere of consciousness. In it, both one's own and the other person's consciousness comes to life. In the moments of its coming to life, the two people are no more enclosed within their own consciousness than they are during sleep. But at other moments, the consciousness of merging with the other reappears. So that in the experience of thinking, the consciousness of each person grasps both itself and the other person. I know that a transcendental realist would call this a relapse into naive realism. Yet, as I have already indicated in this book, naive realism retains its validity in the case of thinking that is experienced. Transcendental realists by no means experience the true state of affairs in the cognitive process. They cut themselves off from it by a web of thoughts in which they then become entangled. Nor should the monism, appearing in intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, the philosophy of freedom, be called epistemological. Rather, if an epithet is wanted, let it be called monism of thought. All of this was misunderstood by Edward von Hartmann. He did not engage the specifics of the presentation in my book, but claimed that I had attempted to unite Hegelian universalist panlogism with Hume's individualistic phenomenalism. In fact, intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, the philosophy of freedom, has nothing to do with these two standpoints that it is supposedly attempting to unite. Parenthesis, this is also why I could not, for example, enter into a discussion of Johannes Remke's epistemological monism. The viewpoint of intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, the philosophy of freedom, is completely different from what von Hartmann and others call epistemological monism. Parenthesis. End of the first addendum. Number two. In the following, what stood as a kind of preface to the first edition is reproduced in all essentials. I place it here as an appendix, not because it has anything immediately to do with the book's contents, but because it shows the mood of thought in which I wrote the book 25 years ago. Since there is a recurrent idea that I have to suppress some of my earlier writings on account of my later ones on spiritual science, I do not want to omit it altogether. Footnote. Only the very first introductory sentences of this preface in the first edition have been completely omitted. Today they seem to me quite inessential. But what is said in the rest of it seems to me necessary to say, even today, in spite of, indeed because of, the natural scientific thinking of our contemporaries. End of footnote, the author's note. Our age wants to draw forth truth only from the depths of the human being. Of Schiller's two well-known paths, our present age prefers the second, quote, "We both seek truth, you in outer life, I within, in the heart, and thus each is sure to find it. If the eye is healthy, it meets the Creator without. If the heart is healthy, it surely mirrors the world within." End of quote, and that's from Johann Christoph Friedrich von Schiller, 1759-1805, great German dramatist, aesthetic philosopher, and critic. End of footnote. Truth that comes to us from without always bears about it the stamp of uncertainty. We want to believe only what appears to each of us inwardly as truth. Only truth can bring us certainty in the development of our individual powers. These powers are lamed in anyone tormented by doubts. In a world of riddles, people cannot find a goal for their activity. We no longer want merely to believe. We want to know. Belief demands the recognition of truths that we do not quite understand. But whatever we do not completely comprehend goes against the individual element in us that wants to experience everything in its deepest inner core. The only knowing that satisfies us is the kind that submits to no outer norm, but springs from the inner life of the personality. Nor do we want the kind of knowing that has become frozen once and for all in academic rules and preserved in compendia valid for all time. We consider ourselves justified in proceeding from our closest experiences, our immediate life, and ascending from there to cognition of the whole universe. We strive for certain knowledge, each of us in his or her own way. Nor should the teaching of science assume a form in which its recognition is a matter of unconditional compulsion. None of us would give a scientific text the title Fichte once did, quote, "a crystal clear report to the greater public on the true nature of the latest philosophy, an attempt to compel readers to understand," end quote. Today no one should be compelled to understand. We demand neither recognition nor agreement from those who are not driven to a given opinion by their own particular individual needs. We do not want to cram knowledge into even an immature human being, a child, rather. We try to develop the child's capacities so that the child no longer needs to be compelled to understand, but wants to understand. I am under no illusion as to this characteristic of my time. I know how much automatism, devoid of individuality, prevails. But I am also just as aware that many of my contemporaries seek to orient their lives in the direction that I have suggested here. I would like to dedicate this book to them. It is not supposed to lead to the only possible path to truth, but to describe the path taken by one for whom truth is central. This text leads first through abstract regions where thought must draw sharp contours so as to arrive at some secure positions. But the reader is also led from arid concepts into concrete life. I am certainly of the opinion that one must also lift oneself into the ethereal realm of concepts if one is to experience every aspect of existence. Someone who knows only how to enjoy use of the senses does not really know the most delicious part of life. Oriental sages have their students first spend years in renunciation and asceticism before they share with them what they know. The West no longer requires pious exercises or asceticism to attain knowledge, but it does demand the goodwill to remove oneself for a brief time from the immediate impressions of life and enter the world of pure thought. The realms of life are many. For each, specific sciences develop. But life itself is a unity, and the more the sciences busily immerse themselves in separate realms, the farther they move away from seeing the living wholeness of the world. There must be a kind of knowing that seeks in the separate sciences the elements that lead human beings back to full life again. A scientific specialist wants to become aware of the world and how it works through his or her insights. In this book, the goal is philosophical. Science itself is to become organically alive. The separate sciences are preludes to the science attempted here. A similar relationship obtains in the arts. A composer works on the basis of compositional theory, which is a sum of all that one needs to know before one can compose. In composing, the laws of composition serve life, serve reality. In just the same way, philosophy is an art. All real philosophers have been artists in concepts. For them, human ideas have become artistic materials and scientific methods have become artistic technique. Thereby, abstract thinking attains concrete individual life. Ideas become powers of life. Then we not merely know about things, but have made knowing into a real self-governing organism. Our active, real consciousness has lifted itself above mere passive reception of truths. How philosophy as an art relates to human freedom, what freedom is, and whether we do or can participate in it, this is the principal theme of my book. All other scientific discussions are included only because in the end they throw light on these, in my view, most immediate human questions. These pages are meant to offer a philosophy of freedom. If it were not aimed at heightening the value of existence for the human personality, all science would be nothing but satisfaction of idle curiosity. The sciences attain their true value only by showing the human significance of their results. The ultimate goal of an individual cannot be ennoblement of only a single capacity of the soul. Rather, it must be the development of all the capacities dormant within us. Knowledge has value only through contributing to the all-around development of the whole of human nature. Therefore, this book interprets the relationship of science to life not in the sense that human beings must bow down before the idea and dedicate their forces to its service, but rather in the sense that we take possession of the world of ideas to use them for our human goals, which extend beyond those of mere science. We must be able to confront an idea while experiencing it. Otherwise, we fall into its bondage. That is the end of the last appendix and the full end of the book, A Philosophy of Freedom, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, by Rudolf Steiner.